In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
In the span of 1 week in August, 3 Ontario women were murdered, all in separate cases, all allegedly at the hands of a man they knew. Sandra Finn of Peterborough was shot dead in a Home Depot parking lot. Her husband, Terrence Finn, charged with first-degree murder. Just days earlier, Wendy Allen and John Allen both died of gunshot wounds in a cabin in Kawartha Lakes. Her death was ruled a homicide, his a suicide. These deaths were followed by a dramatic home explosion in Kitchener, Ontario, which killed 58-year-old Edra Hahn. Her husband, Udo Hahn, was airlifted to hospital, and the investigation is still ongoing. By month's end, the number of women and girls killed this year so far would reach 106, all victims of what violence against women activists call femicide. That tally comes from a new report published by the Canadian Femicide Observatory for Justice and Accountability, which found nearly one-third of these women killed were older than age 55, that more than half of them were killed in their own homes, and that shooting was the most common murder method. It also reported this staggering statistic. A woman or girl is murdered in Canada every other day. What is going on? And how do we make sense of so many women's deaths being linked to misogyny? I'm Sarah Bosveld, senior writer at Chatelaine. This is The Big Story.
So it seems like it's an appropriate time to understand femicide in a slightly broader way.
Pamela Cross is a feminist lawyer and legal director of Luke's Place, a support and resource center for women in Kingston, Ontario. Hi, Pam. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Sarah.
So the term femicide isn't commonly used or widely understood, I think. Can you shed a little more light on what this means and how you truly sort of identify a death as a femicide?
I think the most technical definition of femicide is to say it's the killing of women, usually but not always by men, because they're women. Let's say somebody kills a woman in a car accident. That wouldn't, unless it could be proven that it was deliberately done because she was a woman, that wouldn't be an act of femicide. Traditionally, and even by traditionally, I only mean in the last 30 years or so, that word has been really understood to mean the killing of a woman by her partner or former partner. So what we would more correctly call domestic homicide. But what we're seeing now, especially in the last year or so, is that increasingly there are people who are understanding and using the word femicide to mean acts of killing of women by men outside that intimate partner context, where there can be found to be a misogynist or sexist basis for the killing.
It's a little more broad than just a domestic situation, which is seems to be the narrower context that we have understood in, as violence against women deaths.
That's right. We've very much focused on domestic homicides, and there's no shortage of those. But increasingly now we're looking at it in a somewhat broader context. And I think there's a few reasons for that. One of them is that, and this is based largely on American research, just because of the fact that mass killings are much more common in the United States than anywhere else in the world. And the research being done over the past couple of years into the almost always men who commit those mass killings, whoever they kill in the mass killing, almost all of the time, those men have a history of intimate partner violence that may have included killing their partner either as part of the mass killing or immediately before, or it may not. So I think one of the things that's happening is that as we're understanding, there is a fairly direct line between men who engage in misogynist-based abuse of their intimate partners and men who commit other acts of violence, particularly mass killings. We're starting to understand that maybe we have to think about femicide slightly differently than we have. So, for instance, in Canada, the most notable story about that would be the van attack in Toronto. Right. Earlier this year.
Good evening. We are learning more about that deadly van rampage.
7 minutes. That's all it took from the first 911 call. And all that occurred in between, of course, is what the horror. 10 people left dead.
And I think many people looking at it from outside, and I was one of those people when I just first read the headlines and the immediate stories, I didn't make any connection to violence against women. I thought, well, this is somebody who's killed a whole lot of people, many of whom are women. But as we learned more about the man who's been charged in that situation, we've learned that he has a very misogynist past and is part of online communities of men who are highly misogynist. Obviously, I'm not in a position, I'm sure you're not either, to comment on whether he aimed his van to hit as many women as he could or he didn't, but there's certainly a connection between his actions that day on Yonge Street in Toronto and a history of hatred of women. So it seems like it's an appropriate time to understand femicide in a slightly broader way.
Yeah,
than we have traditionally.
Right. And so the number that has been sort of put out there lately, I think the latest tally is 106 Canadian women and girls killed by femicide. Sounds like an awful lot.
It's huge.
It's huge, though.
It's huge.
I mean, that's a lot of women and girls.
That's right. I certainly noticed in early March that there had been a phenomenal number of women in Ontario killed. So if we look at some of the averages over time, in 2016, for instance, Canada's chief public health officer in his report on intimate partner violence identified that one woman is killed every 4 days by a male family member and one every 6 days by her current or former partner. So there are more women killed by male family members and slightly fewer women killed by current or former partners. So let's just say on average in Canada, a woman is killed once every 6 days by her current or former partner. So these numbers that we're looking at this year are astronomically higher than that. And even if we take out the 8 women who were killed in the van attack, if we just want to try to simplify the numbers for a minute, we don't get anywhere close to this. So the higher numbers can really only be explained a little bit by the fact that we're now using a broader definition of what we mean when we talk about victims of femicide. As to why, I think if we knew the answer to that, we'd be able to very quickly start to bring those numbers down.
For sure.
It's certainly the case that always the numbers go up and down a little bit. There have been years in the past where, you know, in a one-month period, enough women were killed that it got us to half the annual average, but then the other months of the year were disproportionately low. I think we're kind of beyond that now, given that it's we're 4 months from the end of the year. And we're looking at these kinds of extremely high numbers. One of the things that seemed to be the case in the femicides that I looked at earlier in the year, and I have to admit I haven't had time to look at the more recent killings in quite as much detail, is that increasingly family members are being killed as well as the woman, and those are identified as acts of femicide as well. When I looked at the numbers in early March, there had been 15 people killed in acts of femicide. 10 of those were what I would call the direct intended
target
victim, the partner, the former partner. But there were 5 family members, in 2 cases, elderly mothers of the partner or former partner. In another case, it was a teenage child, and so on. So if you think that we identify 15 victims of femicide, one-third of those are not the primary target. And so, you know, as these men who decide that they want to take out their rage, their anger, their loss of power and control on their partner, begin to see it as acceptable to include anybody else who's in the room, numbers are going to go up, clearly.
Yeah, and it also makes the point, too, that this affects a family, a community. It's not just a personal thing between a man and a woman often. And that's, you know, a lot of the discussion around how domestic homicide maybe more particularly gets talked about. It's like, well, that's a private matter, or that there must have been more to it that, you know, aggravated this violence. You know, I think it kind of speaks to some of the societal attitudes around that, too, right?
That's a really important point, and the Boris Beretsky case is a really interesting example of what you're talking about. For those who are listening to this who don't remember that case, he killed 3 of his former partners or women he'd been involved with in one morning. in Renfrew County, a small rural part of Ontario. And I spent a lot of time in that community in the months and years following those murders, supporting mostly the women's organizations that were supporting family members. And one of the things that I was struck by, because we heard it again and again and again, was that the entire community was affected and felt victimized. And I think most interestingly, at the sentencing hearing for Mr. Barutsky, the community submitted a victim impact statement, which was incredibly powerful. The statement itself was powerful. But as I sat in court the day that the sentence was given by the judge, it was really powerful to hear him reflect on the importance of understanding the impact of these three murders on the entire community.
And it feels like we've talked a lot about violence against women in recent years. You know, wouldn't you think that more focus on this issue would contribute to the number of murders going down? Or are we sometimes talking in silos or circles and not doing enough on the ground? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, we're for sure not doing enough on the ground, because if we were, as you say, the numbers would go down. Shelters across the country remain full. We know that violence against women is something that is better understood. It's okay to talk about it now. So that, to some extent, explains why numbers of women in shelters are going up. You know, as more women feel comfortable talking about it, they become more aware of services in their communities, they're more likely to leave.
Get help, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I would say, with the exception of this year, where the numbers seem to have really skewed up, the number of homicides has stayed fairly constant. Mm-hmm. There is a disconnect, I think, between conversation and action. I think there is some difficulty, and I understand this, for people to believe that it could happen to someone they know. So while people might have a conversation, like an extended family or a social group or a church group or something, how many people then say, but let's actually look at the risk factors? Mm-hmm. I think that's a very difficult step to take, because in a way, because of a good thing about people, we don't like to believe that other people are capable of doing this terrible thing. The frustrating thing for those of us who work with women in these situations is that we actually have the information we need. Thanks to the work of the Domestic Violence Death Review Committee in Ontario, we know what risk factors are very clearly, because we see the same risk factors in significantly high numbers of domestic homicides. The highest risk factor, of course, is a prior history of domestic violence. But the second highest risk factor, and it's almost as high as the first, and it's way higher than all the rest, is a recent or pending separation. And so when we look at how we can possibly reduce the rate of domestic homicide, it's not just about things like criminal charges and locking people up. That may well be part of the solution. It's not just about getting rid of guns, although that would help. It's about what's going on in family court, because this is where families go at the point of separation, and it's at that stage that many, not all, but many of these women are being killed.
And it's also maybe being aware around you of that risk, you know, knowing that elevated level of danger when, you know, someone in your life has broken up with a partner and they've exhibited some concerning behavior before. What can someone in that situation maybe do, I suppose, to intervene? It's not always safe to just talk to them outwardly, right?
No, it's not. I would want to be a much more skilled person than I am to have that conversation with the person who I think might cause the harm. I think a good place is to have a conversation with the woman, because many women downplay the level of risk. They too can't believe that whatever their partner may have said to them, he would actually be capable of killing them. They think that by leaving, they're leaving the abuse behind. So I think starting with a conversation with the woman to say, you know, I'm concerned about your safety. What can we do to help keep you safer? It's not talking about going after your former partner. It's about building a safety system around you. I think that family law lawyers have to get better at identifying the presence of domestic violence. You know, there's no automatic screening that family law lawyers are required to do when they open a new family law file. And of course, not every client who comes for family law advice is leaving an abusive relationship, but a heck of a lot of them are. And so I think there needs to be screening right from the get-go by lawyers. And we've seen some movement. You know, several provinces in Canada now have what they're calling domestic violence leave legislation that lets a victim of domestic violence take some time off work to move, to get herself to a place of safety, to consult with a lawyer, and so on. The federal government is introducing legislation to do the same thing for federally regulated employers. That's a helpful step. A number of provinces have gender-based violence or domestic violence strategies in place. We need to move from the understanding that it's a problem through talking about the solutions to actually implementing the solutions.
And implementing them in a way that actually makes a difference in women's lives, like something like the domestic violence leave. You know, if that is a law regulated, an employer has to abide and give you that space, right? You know, and then therefore, if these changes happen, maybe it can become more of a norm and become, you know, more accepted and embraced. You know, that really it's a community effort to keep women safe, right?
Yep. It takes it out of the closet. It takes it out of the that's a private problem. And all of that is good. But at the same time, we have to be looking at actual steps in law. We have to look at the issue holistically. We've got to end women's poverty, for example, so that women aren't left in situations where they're so financially dependent on an abusive partner.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're off to a good start this year, I suppose, at least in keeping track, as disheartening as those numbers are. Thank you so much for joining us, Pam.
You're very welcome.
Pamela Cross is a feminist lawyer and legal director of Luke's Place. That was The Big Story. For more, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You could also reach out on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Big Story Podcast. And make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Sarah Bosveld. Thank you so much for listening.